get it.
They're saying it's their show, so they get to bring it over. So are you taking it to Jack? Why don't you see?
Just make sure the red light's on when you try to record.
I can just pick you up. What happened to Russ?
Put it back.
Okay. I think we can start without him. Testing 1, 2, 3. I guess this is... Okay. Good morning. We'll call this meeting to order. We've got a list of people that are want to testify, and I think there's some that are not on the list, and we'll just take you kind of on a Quaker basis. You raise your hand and come forward and testify. Don't let the ads put you off. I saw in the paper that, could you turn that? I'm getting feedback from my own voice here. That this was called the House of Permanent Fund, like the House of Pancakes. This is a special House Special Committee on the Permanent Fund. And Ernie Hagen, Representative Ernie Hagen's on the committee from Petersburg, and he told me this morning that he heard on the radio that this meeting was to hear from you folks on how to spend the fund. I can assure you that's not our intention. We want to hear how we can preserve that fund, and we're just as interested in what you want, what you don't want the fund to do as what you want it to do. And we had a very interesting hearing in Fairbanks. And we heard a lot of what people wanted it to do and they didn't want it to do. And since it's your fund, and before we actually draft specific legislation for consideration of the whole legislature, we want to hear your philosophical approach. So this is, don't feel you have to be an investment banker. We're really talking about philosophy today. Also with the committee is Representative Bill Miles. And Representative Russ Meekins, who's on the committee, will be here shortly. Our AA to the committee is Mike Dugan, and he may be asking some questions today. Do you have any statements, anybody you'd like to make? Okay, our first witness is Senator Joe Arcini. Right there. We got some bum mics, so we're short.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to make a little pitch here. I will be brief. The permanent, my concern is not at this point with what the uses of the permanent fund ought to be, but how these uses are to be determined. To a large extent, the legislature will set undoubtedly broad policy guidelines, but the actual management of those guidelines will be done by somebody. Some group of people, and I'd like to address my remarks to how that group of people comes into being chosen. The permanent fund was overwhelmingly adopted by the public last year, as we all know. I suspect that your hearings are turning up a variety of opinions when it gets down to the specifics of how that money ought to be used. I would also imagine that probably there isn't a great deal of coalescence of public opinion at this point, and people are kind of vague about it, except for those people who happen to be in the investment or some other kind of industry that's directly involved with it. I would also suspect that despite the good efforts of this committee in trying to get the issue before the public, that until something really happens or until the fund is sizable, such that the impact is being felt substantially in whatever quarters that money is being spent, that the general public will not become deeply involved in the issue. I could be wrong, but I think that's what was likely to happen. On the other hand, people who are knowledgeable about such things as large investment funds maintain that those who control this fund will be extremely powerful in a political economic sense in the state, and probably to the extent that the size of this fund in the next 5 to 10 years is probably unprecedented with respect to any other state in the union as a proportion of our, say, state budget. This concept of the power of the fund manager will probably come to pass. For these reasons, it's my opinion that the managers of this fund ought to be people who are directly accountable to the people, the voters, the general public of the state, as opposed to being selected by some other secondary or tertiary method, such as a panel selects potential people from whom the governor selects. This is sort of a circuitous approach, which in my opinion ought not to be implemented. I think those fund managers ought to be directly accountable to the public. As the public sees a need for change in the way in which that fund is invested or used, that change will be reflected in the debate when these people run for their office. And of course, it ought to be a full-paid, full-time type of office, not just a token or a, kind of like boards and commissions, but a full-time, full-paid position. The people who run for that, I would think that the public would demand that they have some ability or expertise in handling money, or in that it is more strictly aimed at than, say, the legislature, which is a very broad kind of thing. I think the problem with, say, a gubernatorial appointment is that every 4 years the governor runs for election, and many, many issues that the governor has control of are discussed, and the permanent fund will be lost in many other issues that the governor is involved in, any governor. I think that this is important enough so that it ought to be separately elected. The framers of the Constitution, the state Constitution, of course, determined that the governor is the one that has all the appointing authority, and there are no other elective offices on a statewide basis other than the legislature. But I think since the Constitution was framed more than 20 years ago, that things have changed substantially. And we're into an era now with the oil starting to flow of a yet greater change than we've seen in the past. And this change should give one to reason to take another look at the constitutional concept of only the governor being elected, and look at those kind of offices that are perhaps genuine statewide importance, to have statewide input for those of particular concern. That's really the extent of my testimony. I would urge you to take a look at the concept of basically having elected people managing the fund. It can be done without changing the Constitution, as long as the governor has some choice. You can have elected officials, is what I'm told by Legislative Affairs Agency. Of course, the cleanest way is a constitutional amendment.
Thank you, Senator. Can you stay for a few questions? Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Miles.
Senator, how would you set up the, you mentioned the qualifications for these this fund manager, they would have to be people with expertise. Have you given any thought as to how you would qualify that? I mean, I don't think a judge, today's language, has to be an attorney. I don't think the pope has to be a priest. How would you set these qualifications up?
I wouldn't. I would let the public. Presumably, running for the legislature, you don't have to be an expert in anything. The legislature deals with all kinds of things, and just by living, you've been involved in many of these things.
I won't touch that.
whereas I think the permanent fund is different. It is a function of investment, and I would think that the public would only vote for those people who at least have some sort of abilities or have evidenced some sort of experience in finance. Maybe it's been a banker, maybe it's been a union fund manager, maybe it's been a whole raft of things that become involved in financial implications.
But you would first have the public set up the background essentials,
no.
And then?
I think it ought to be an elective office, period, with no other than I would have no more restrictions on that office than I would have restrictions on an office for the legislature.
Oh, I see. I thought you were implying that you descriptions. I missed your note.
I think the public, as the public, will vote for those people who have some of those qualifications or have evidence of some of those qualifications.
Okay, thank you.
No, I don't.
Mike?
Senator, have you given any thought to whether these people would be elected on a statewide basis or by region or anything like that?
I would support a district basis to ensure that there are a variety of interests. I suspect that your hearings in various parts of the state have borne that out, that there are different parts of the state do have different concepts how that fund should be used. I think on a district basis would be preferable. It may be, my suggestion would be, some combination of existing election districts, so that you would group an individual would run for a seat that would be comprised of several election districts, so that you wouldn't have to have new election districts to try and figure out people who would run.
Well, Senator, you've hit on probably one of the more difficult issues for the legislature, and that is the issue of control. I mean, when you have a sizable fund, people are concerned about who's going to control it. It occurs to me that what we'd have there is we'd be establishing two legislatures. And to the extent that you increase the size of the permanent fund, you'd have a competing legislature. And whether you needed a constitutional amendment or not, I think you do. Do you see any problem with, you know, establishing essentially two legislatures and with a very strong executive in this state? Wouldn't that kind of tip the balance in the Constitution where we have a legislature, although not a match for the strong executive? At least it's one body and has the power of the purse. This might fragment us into two. Have you considered that aspect of it?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think you'd have two legislatures. I think you may have two legislatures if you, for example, took certain legislators and put them as the permanent fund managers, and they would almost be operating as a separate legislature. But this is a separate body, and this body would still be subject to the laws passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. And I would presume that we would have laws of general conceptual appropriateness to the way in which the permanent fund is used, and this group would have to operate under those laws. But still, like any law, whatever executive authority it is has a varying amount of leeway depending on how tightly those laws are written. I don't think you would have another group, just as you have an executive and you have a judiciary and you have the legislative groups now. This would, to some extent, for the more narrow confines of investments, would, I suppose, be almost a competing group, because it would have also direct public accountability. But I don't think you're getting into a separate legislature. A lot of it depends on what the ultimate will of the legislature is with respect to the types of uses this permanent fund is put to. Basically, if the legislature decides anything other than maximizing a safe return on the investment, then you're subsidizing some group. It may be homeowners, it may be investing people, it may be fishermen, it may be farmers, it may be any one of countless number of groups, whether of narrow constituency or broad statewide, still a some special group or a series of special groups, as opposed to maximizing investment, having that investment come into the general fund for use in the legislative determination of how the funding should be spent.
You raise an interesting point there. You're saying that, if I understood it correctly, that when you're dealing with anything but, say, you know, a sole criterion of maximizing income, there's usually some subsidy involved, and that if you're going to do that, there ought to be some equity or some representation. Is that, in other words, if you're going to dole out subsidies, it ought not to be done, let's say, at the decision of some expert, but rather somebody who's responsive to as an elected official.
Yes.
Well, let me toss this out as an alternative to that. Is that to the extent that you get into programs which involve subsidies, What do you think of handling it as we do now with the general fund loan programs? In other words, establish them out of the general fund. But with the permanent fund, you establish that criteria of maximum, of conservation of principal and return to income. In other words, rather than do everything you have been doing with the general fund, put the permanent fund off to the side and say, okay, we're not, that's the one fund that is not going to be, let's say, doled out as, let's say, political pressures dictate, but will be, at least for the short run, be set aside for just preserving capital and producing income. And that way you don't have that accountability problem as difficult as you do when you get into subsidies.
I think I've been on record as personally supporting that concept. Certainly in the short run, as the permanent fund grows and as the public becomes more aware of it, maybe we'll change our policy at some point. But I think in certainly in the near future, it ought to be managed for maximum safe return on investment.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Thank you,
Senator. Our next listed witness is Robert Rutherford. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear. I'm not exactly consider myself very experienced at these things. I hope I understand the intent of the hearing. My business, as you may know, is a consulting engineer working primarily with the electric utilities throughout Alaska. So most of my experience in Alaska, since I came here in 1950, has been related primarily to the electric utility industry. Along the way, in working with these utilities, of course, the business of providing money for the development of electricity, that unique energy that really contributes to quality of life, is one of the things that we're constantly dealing with. And I have some thoughts to share with you, and I hope in along the way that I can understand the intent better so that I can add to this with some written testimony, which I can supply later when I have the opportunity to submit some things in writing.
Yes, and I'd like to say for everyone here that we'll accept written statements anytime until the time of the session. There are kind of informational booklets the committee's prepared with a questionnaire in the back. Feel free to help yourself to that. And Paul, why don't you take a stack of that so people don't have to come up with this and grab them, they can help themselves. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Well, let me recite a few areas where it's occurred to me that the permanent fund or something similar to it, at this point I'm trying to understand what some of the concepts for it might, what others might be thinking about for this fund too, but let me talk about these briefly. There's several areas where I believe that the use of the permanent fund might be valuable to Alaska. And first off, I'd start out with saying that I believe, and my understanding of the permanent fund, that its use should be on a basis for its return. In other words, that it's not intended as a gift, that it should be used in the manner that it is returned to the permanent fund if it's loaned on various bases. So my own personal feelings are that the fund should be used in that manner so that it is not, doesn't become part of a system of grants, perhaps.
That's a constitutional requirement, the way that it only can be fairly read to preclude grants. It would have to be income producing.
That probably was in my head from some back a ways, but I'd forgotten that it was already a constitutional provision. One of the areas where I believe the fund could be used, I'd like to talk about a minute, is perhaps might be considered as marginal in the sense of whether or not it might be a grant, but let me explain. There are a number of projects that I have seen as potential in Alaska, which are of the nature of being somewhat unconventional because of the unique requirements of some Alaska situations. So there are some areas where, I'm speaking of the electric utility business, where the utilities could use some support for projects that engineers such as myself believe are feasible projects and good projects, but at the same time they may be somewhat unconventional, and on that account have some difficulty in obtaining funding from the more usual sources. I'll give you an example or two. There has been under study by the Alaska Power Administration some ways in which electric energy can be brought to some of the small villages of Alaska on a basis that's perhaps a little more reliable and feasible than some of the present systems that are in use, namely small individual generating plants scattered around in the various isolated villages. In an effort to evaluate whether there are some alternatives to that, and in particular, see if there's some possibility of being able to deliver forms of energy that can displace fossil fuels. The Alaska Power Administration has, in this case, asked us to do some studies relating to interconnecting villages with transmission lines or lines of some kind, whereby a group could then receive energy from a larger central supply source or perhaps a small hydroelectric project. And of course, as you know, hydroelectric projects are determined by where the water is and where there's the head, and invariably it's necessary to take that energy and deliver it. So in the small village communities, the only alternatives are to figure out a way to interconnect. There's a concept that I've presented in these reports that is not unique in the world, but it is somewhat unconventional. It's what I call a one-wire ground return system of transmitting electricity. It's been used in many parts of the world. The technology is well known. It's not something that's R&D. It is unconventional. And there's this small report here that's been prepared suggesting a demonstration project along the Kuskokwim, perhaps centered around Bethel, to interconnect some of the villages that are now supplied primarily by little individual generating plants, in some cases just that each home has its own plant. In some of the villages there is a centralized system. And for such a project, I'm convinced that eventually a project of this kind can probably be financed by REA funds, for example. But at the moment, its unique characteristic is such that REA says, well, it isn't exactly according to our specifications, our standards. I've had some nice discussions with them, for example, and I can see their engineers, believe me, but there's a few hang-ups that relate to the uniqueness of the system. And I'm suggesting that perhaps through the use of the permanent fund and the whoever operates it, that some of these unique solutions that may be adaptable to Alaska be given consideration, that perhaps some of the funds could be used as a pilot project, which I'm saying again is not R&D, may be unconventional, but I'm convinced would be feasible. But you could then produce what might be called a yardstick. That word's been used in other areas to say this is a feasible project, and that means generate additional support from such as REA by saying, here's a project that works, this is the way it's doing, we'd like to build a lot more of it. And in the case of REA, the whole philosophy behind their loan program is such that to me it's a natural to do this kind of thing. But it does need a little yardstick, something to get it going. And say maybe the permanent fund as an Alaska fund can help produce a yardstick program that is required for Alaskans because of the unique or unconventional nature of some of the solutions we have to deal with. Along with this one wire scheme, it just happens also that in the Bethel region, there are some interesting records regarding wind. There's some possibility for the use of wind power to supplement diesel generation, and because the delivery costs of fuel, etc., are pretty high, while the costs of energy in those regions are exceedingly high. And even though wind power generation is a very high cost scheme basically today, some of the figures we have digested make it look as though it might be useful if it were part of an integrated system where it's not the sole source of energy, but simply used as a supplement to displace higher cost diesel fuel. So the little report suggests the possibility of adding a little wind generation to find out if that is true. In another area of the supply of power, electrical power, to small villages. Now, you're all acquainted with AVEC. I think most of you know about the Alaska Village Electric Co-op, which is attempting to do the job throughout Alaska. Using REA money, practically all the plants that are in use are diesel plants, isolated with the same problems that I'm talking about here. I think in some cases we can show that interconnection can help that. But there are some other things that can be done besides the one wire line, for example, and that would be some improvements in the design of diesel electric generating equipment. And here again, there are a number of things that are available in the industry. We're not talking about R&D, but we are talking about something that would be a little bit unconventional, and somebody would have to spend a little bit of money to put in the first set. And one of the areas I'm talking about in the operation of diesel electric equipment, one of the big difficulties in these isolated areas is in operating the equipment in a reasonably efficient mode. And with the electric load bouncing up and down over the daylight, nighttime hours, it's difficult to keep a generating unit running at an efficient load. So conventional designs of such equipment, having been developed over the years using the trade-offs of fuel costs and other things that generated those designs by the manufacturers, have resulted in designs that are not necessarily adaptable to some of the problems we've got now, with resulting from high fuel costs and the very isolated nature of some of these systems. Here again, we believe, and there's other engineers who would go along with this, I'm sure, that there are some modifications of standard generating devices that can be developed, put on a pilot project, and shown to be workable. Now, perhaps this is something that could be done in some other ways too, but I'm using it as an example to say there are some solutions that I believe as an engineer are adaptable to Alaska conditions, or they might not have been thought about or even useful on the basis of the trade-offs in other areas. And perhaps an Alaska fund, permanent fund, can look with a different eye on the things that are peculiarly Alaskan in terms of some of the solutions that we need to find. Now, getting away from the pilot nature, yardstick nature of project, which these first ones I talked about are, I would suggest some other areas where I believe the Permanent Fund could do some great things for communities of Alaska in energy. And that would be for the fund to participate in some manner with communities in funding for renewable resource projects such as hydroelectric developments. And probably I don't have to tell you about hydro. I know that Ernie has been pounding the table for help in hydroelectric in the communities of southeastern Alaska for a long time. And I'm sure that he would feel that this permanent fund could be a tremendous aid to the communities of that area. And what I'm suggesting is perhaps there's three modes of participation that might be considered. One of them, of course, would be just a complete funding of a hydroelectric project on a loan basis, long term, an appropriate interest rate, lower interest rate, loan to accomplish a hydroelectric project. Through the use of the Water Resources Revolving Fund, which has been operating for a year or two, some communities have been able to get front money to investigate such projects and get them up to the point where it's a go or no go proposition, and then they're faced, of course, with going to the bond market or looking for other sources of funding to actually accomplish the project itself. And that's where I'm suggesting that the permanent fund could participate, either complete funding, perhaps partial funding, and maybe there would be other sources of money, but there'd be mutual benefit in lowering interest rates, etc., if the permanent fund could participate with a portion of it. And perhaps a third way would be using the permanent fund in a guarantee mode of some kind to guarantee a project rather than using the monies directly to back up a community in an offering of a bond with a guarantee of sorts. Perhaps I'm influenced to some extent in these thoughts by the fact I've been working with REA for a long time, the federal agency. And today, they use those three modes for working with the utilities that they finance. One is the direct loan program, in which, as you know, I'm sure they have two interest rates that are used. They have a certain amount of the money that's loaned out at 2% interest on a 35-year basis. They have some other direct loans they make at 5% interest on 35-year loans. And they also have a participation program with other lending agencies where they loan part of the money, and then they have the guarantee program. And I'm suggesting that perhaps the permanent fund could look to communities for help in energy projects in a similar manner, that there may be something really worth looking at there for the use of that permanent fund. To speak a little more in particular about renewable resource projects and what it means to Alaska, the hydroelectric development has one thing about it that is, more than one thing, but the thing I'm referring to, one thing about it that's quite different than other energy projects, and that is that once it's built, its costs, for all practical purposes, do not escalate. And as a practical matter today, we know that almost everything else has been escalating at a pretty substantial rate. And most of the economists that make any kinds of forecasts at all agree generally that escalation is part of the real world, and it's something that ought to be considered when you compare alternate projects of one kind or another. And this is one very important difference between the hydroelectric development and alternate energy, electric energy supply systems that use fuel. Because, as we all know, sorely fuel costs certainly have been escalating, and it looks like they're going to continue to escalate because of the fact that we're running out of fuel. And just for the purpose of finding more of it and developing the lesser profitable fuel resources, we know we're looking at escalation. On the other hand, the hydroelectric project, once it's built, the sun does the job. It's solar energy, really, and it's free. The falling water is there. It does not escalate. So then obviously there are tremendous benefits to a community when a hydroelectric development can take place and displace the fuel they might otherwise have to buy at an escalating rate. And I've made some estimates over a period from now to year 2000, and the differences are startling. If you compare, you assume some reasonable escalation rate and make a comparison. So while the support of a project of that kind, I'm suggesting by the permanent fund, would be on a loan basis if you get your money back like any other loan, it would have a tremendous spin-off on the community itself and obviously the state in terms of, number one, lesser costs to the community. Number two, stretching the fossil fuel resource because it displaces what would otherwise have to be consumed in the fossil resource. Another area that the permanent fund might find use, and this one is perhaps a little more way out, pardon the expression. I think it's real, however, in that there may be some opportunities for the permanent fund to be used this way, and that would have to do with some more major developments of energy systems in Alaska, such as the support, perhaps through the use of guarantees. I'm not suggesting direct loans in this case, but that it could be very influential in the feasibility of such projects. A major project such as a generation and transmission system for Central Alaska, which would extend from Anchorage to Prudhoe Bay. As some of you may know, I've suggested electrification of the gas line and oil line routes. I believe that it's feasible because the energy displaced by such electrification has a pretty fancy value today. And if you look at the value of the energy that's displaced, it would otherwise be burned in the simple transportation of the energy through Alaska. You can show that I believe that the electric generation would be feasible just from an economic point of view. And of course, it would again substantially impact those fuels, which the ones I'm talking about now are oil and gas. Now, where do you get the electricity to do this? Well, there's other fossil resources such as coal. I believe that coal-fired electric energy can probably be feasible to displace oil and gas. Coal at the present time in our thinking about fuels is at a lower priority than gas and oil, so it might be useful to displace that oil and gas. And obviously, hydroelectric energy could certainly be used to do the job. It does also appear along the way, though, that the hydroelectric projects that we're looking at today in this region, which in this case would be like the Susitna development, that most of that hydroelectric energy can actually be absorbed for other purposes in Alaska. It can be used by the communities for their normal load growth of Anchorage, the Fairbanks, this central area. I'm suggesting that if projects such as this catch on in any sense, that perhaps the permanent fund can be helpful in improving feasibility of such a project. A similar project could be accomplished in southeastern Alaska. And this is one, the concept of which was talked about many, many years ago by the Forest Service when they made their little study of the water powers of southeast Alaska. They suggested the possibility of an energy intertide throughout the whole of southeastern Alaska through the use of submarine cables, in many cases because of the rugged nature of the country. And I'm saying now that while this concept may be slightly way out, there are developments happening in Alaska which very likely may bring such a suggestion to the fore again but that because of the Alaska conditions that exist, it's going to take Alaska horsepower to make it go, and that permanent fund is certainly is going to be which very likely may bring such a suggestion to the fore again, but that because of the Alaska conditions that exist, it's going to take Alaska horsepower to make it go, and that permanent fund is certainly is going to be a device that would impact projects of that nature. And I'm simply saying that I believe those projects are likely to show feasibility as reviewed by Alaskans. We Alaskans do have some difficulty communicating with other parts of the financial world on some of the things that are unique to Alaska. And this is an area where I believe the permanent fund, using good judgment, I'm not saying do anything silly, but because there will be Alaskans involved, they're probably in a better position to evaluate the kinds of things that I've been talking about in Alaska terms and arrive at a conclusion that says it's a good deal, where the general financial market that we usually look to might not be able to evaluate it that same way, and thereby something might go begging that really is a good project. The permanent fund can, to me, it would seem like could be perform a valuable function in supporting some of those concepts if and when they develop. I guess that's about it, and I'd be I'm intending to put a little more of this in writing, and perhaps you can tell. Portions of this you feel at this point in your hearings would be appropriate related to the permanent fund, and I haven't been in any other hearings, so I don't have the benefit of that.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting and I think comprehensive statement on possibilities of permanent fund participation in energy development. I think we'd like very much to have your written statement. You might include in it maybe some of the reasons REA funding isn't possible for these projects, and any more specifics you have. How the financing might work, but
yes, I have that in some of this. I can do that.
Are there questions from the committee, Mr. Rutherford?
I can ask lots of questions, but I think they'd be a repetition. Principally, what you're saying is that maintaining the idea that the permanent fund principle will remain, but if those projects have to be financed on a long-term, low-interest basis, the state would get its money back. It would be just the thing that, in the early period of using hydro only as an example, the early costs are the ones that put most of us, I'm talking about Wrangell-Petersburg area, out of business. Have that money loaned to us on a long-term, low-interest basis, say at an early startup cost of 3 or 4%.
sooner down the road if we're going to displace these here Mickey Mouse projects we got now with diesel power and just the peaking loads. You're acquainted with our problem in Petersburg that it throws the rate schedule out to the point where you never get out of the woods as far as debt service. In fact, the peaking power costs you more than the primary power. I think this is a. I appreciate the comments that you've made to the committee. I know they're just along the lines that I'm thinking. Look forward to some more of it.
Well, I say again, I believe that the permanent fund can perform a unique function, and I know there's lots of ideas for the use of the permanent fund, so whoever manages that fund has got a problem of spreading it around the state in a fair and best manner for the best interest of the whole state. But when you look at the communities themselves in general and the potential spin-offs, I think the energy area is one place where the use of that fund can result in benefits that will spread throughout most of the population of the state. And it's, there are particular problems related to Alaska. And now Alaska is going to have a particular fund that's also Alaska. And I'm just suggesting that right there, we have an opportunity to do some of the things that we have a little difficulty convincing the rest of the world that are feasible. And through the use of the permanent fund, I believe you can yardstick some stuff so we can get some more money in besides. And that the permanent fund can perhaps be used to really generate additional spin-offs to a lot of the communities.
Any questions? Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next listed witness is Carl Stevie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mr. Quitting. Thank you for the opportunity to appear here. I do not have a prepared text or anything, but I would like to offer some of my thoughts to the committee on the permanent fund. I have asked quite a number of people the question, what's the purpose of the permanent fund, to see what their thoughts were on this permanent fund set up. And needless to say, I received numerous answers, mostly to curb legislative spending, to help all Alaskans, to have some money left when the oil ran out, and a few had the same opinion that I did when the permanent fund was set up. It was to mainly develop renewable resources from the income of non-renewable resources, whether it be oil, gas, minerals, whatever they might be. And I was at the hearings Saturday over at the Anchorage Westward and listened to Dr. Gordon and Dr. Bergman make their presentations, and really I couldn't agree with either one of them on their thoughts of the permanent fund. Dr. Bergman split her ideas straight down three different ways. She had three scenarios that you may remember. One was spend it as you get it, the other was the gilt edge investments, the third was the development fund. I don't subscribe to any of these scenarios per se. I subscribe more to all of them. Not necessarily spend it as you get it, maybe spend the income that would go to the general fund for things like parks, recreation campgrounds, Pioneer Road, disappeared. I might say that for personal reasons, I had to leave the state from 1963 to 1973. I first came to Alaska in 1942. I've been here most of the time since, and in 1963, our roads were in a terrible mess. You couldn't find a campground anywhere. You couldn't find any rest areas. You had to go behind the nearest tree or anything else. When I came back in 73, we had campgrounds like no other state has that I know of. They're everywhere. There's lots of them. We need more. They're crowded. But a lot of that $900 million did some good. It wasn't all rabble, as Dr. Gordon said. And on the second scenario of Dr. Bergman's, I believe that we should have a portion of the permanent fund go into Gilt Edge investments. These would be long-term, high interest bearing investments that would go into our general fund, the income, and reduce some of our taxes. Everybody all over the state, this permanent fund is supposed to help everybody. And I think that we could reduce our taxes with the income about a certain percent. I'm not offering any suggestions on what percent of the permanent fund could be used in Gilt Edge investments. I think that would be to somebody that knows a little more about economics. And thirdly, the development scenario, which I subscribe to wholeheartedly, is long-term low-interest loans or participation loans or guaranteed loans, as Mr. Rutherford pointed out. And I might say that I am an engineer with Robert W. Rutherford Associates, so, and there was no conclusion. We haven't talked together or anything. We didn't even have time to prepare a text. But these three different methods of financing projects should be considered. Again, no giveaway program. It has to be returned to the state. And in the development, I think that we should consider first our renewable resources for these funds. The world is going hungry now for protein. We have a lot of bottom fish. Somebody's going to develop the bottom fishers. Who is going to do it? We need more canneries. We were flying fish to British Columbia, lower 48. They were, well, the other day they lost a plane load of fish flying them from Yakutat to Anchorage. We need no more cold storage plants. Timber resources. A lot of the smaller communities could develop small shingle mills, veneer plants, finished lumber. Who's going to do it? Are we going to do it, or are we going to let the Japanese come in here and do take all of our lumber, our bottom fisheries, build our canneries, or are we going to do it ourselves? And another renewable resource close to my heart is the hydroelectric development. And I would like to say right along with the hydroelectric development, fish hatcheries. You may wonder why I combined these two, but I have worked from Kotzebue to Ketchikan, and this past summer fish run this year. It was a very dry year in southeastern Alaska. There were a lot of smaller streams where the salmon were dying in the mouth of the stream because there wasn't enough water to get up and spawn. And I'm wondering what's going to be 3 or 4 years from now when those fish that would have spawned would have normally came back. In Petersburg, there's a hydroelectric plant. The water from the tail race is utilized in a state fish hatchery. If it had not been for the Petersburg hydroelectric plant, they would not have had enough water to operate their fish hatchery. Also, fry from the fish hatchery was put into streams where the salmon could not get in to spawn. So, in my way of thinking, we can build hydroelectric plants and fish hatcheries at the same time, and we can go Mother Nature one better. We can do a lot of things to enhance the fisheries as well as to develop hydroelectric power. At the present time, in southeastern Alaska, the average fuel costs per kilowatt hour of energy generated is running a little over 4 cents a kilowatt hour. Nearly all of the smaller communities are using diesel electric. A lot of the larger communities are using diesel because of the front end money. It's hard to, for a community of say 1,000 people to go to the market and say we would like to borrow $8 million to build a hydroelectric plant. Well, that's kind of unreasonable for a banker to say, well, here's 1,000 people that come in here and want to borrow $8 million. They're out of their, way out of their league. Personally, I start pulling my hair out when I get an electric bill, and I'm paying about 2 cents a kilowatt hour for it delivered to my home. And these people are paying over 4 cents now just for fuel. And in 1995, they're going to be paying over 13 cents a kilowatt hour for diesel fuel. And I maintain that if you can build a hydroelectric plant at fuel replacement costs at the time it comes on the line, it should be built. And I would like to have the committee really dwell on this development portion of the scenarios that Dr. Bergman put forward. And I think we can use some of the income, say, from the low interest that we get on our development programs, or the high interest from our guild-aided investments, to even build a few amenities for Dr. Gordon, but I would say more in convention centers and that sort of thing, and not opera houses and golf courses. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Carl, I just have one. My brief experience with looking at some hydroelectric projects, at least explained on paper, is that they are expensive. If we're talking about a $2 billion fund, and we consider all the uses that people want the fund to accomplish, like in Fairbanks, we heard everything from artifacts to whales, literally, yesterday. But hydro wasn't mentioned, but I know in other reaches of the state, it's probably, it's more feasible and it's popular. But how many projects do you think the fund could get involved in and still accomplish some of the others? Or do you see a limitation on, in terms of the number of hydro projects that the fund can get involved in?
Yes, that's why I brought out the three different types of financing. Possibly if you had plenty of money, there wasn't a demand for it, you could go in and make a complete loan package for hydroelectric development. Now, I'm talking more of the smaller outlying villages, Dillingham, Kodiak, Petersburg, Metlakatla, Heidelberg, Hickey, Tlaloc, wherever. More so, I think, than I would in actual development of the Pacific. Like I was comparing the energy costs, the rail belt area along the pipeline, I feel, has benefited economically from the oil and gas industry. This same economic enhancement in this area has made a hardship for the rest of Alaska by increasing the wages, the prices of fuel, and one thing or another that the people have to pay. It has done nothing to increase the price of the fish or how much a can of lumber or something like that is going to bring in. But still, they're paying the higher prices in one thing or another. It's hurt them, and it has more or less, I think, helped the Anchorage Fairbanks area and to make it a more equitable thing. I think the fund should be spread out and not one huge hydroelectric plant for one specific area of the state, unless there's the money available. But if you have a limited amount of money, I would say participation. A project costs, small project, say in Petersburg, run $8-10 million. Maybe you could say, well, we'll loan you $3 million. We'll guarantee $6 million. We'll guarantee the loan. You find the money someplace else, but we'll guarantee it. And with that guarantee, they could get a whole lot lower interest rate than somebody else. I mean, it just depends on how much money you have available for the different projects, and it would be a matter of allotting the funds throughout the state.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Stevie. Our next witness is Peter Vandilla. He's still here. Okay, Betsy Woodman. Looks like the way we started off this morning, we didn't get a quarter moon. Yeah. We'll break a little sooner, actually.
I have mine written up because if I were to just talk, I could spend all the rest of your hearing time because of this the subject has such broad interest to me. I'm not an expert in investment and management things, and I won't address myself to that particularly except to suggest to the committee that there be an investigation of the state bank concept that is, and Dakota's not going to like this, but I don't know whether it's North or South Dakota, but it has it. I know a little bit about
North,
it.
North.
But I do have a statement, and I'll read it for you. First, I'll identify myself. My name is Betsy Woodman, and my profession is writer. I first met Alaska in 1953 when my husband was assigned here with the Air Force. We extended his two-year tour because we had fallen in love with the place after a brief hiatus in California where he decided to retire from the Air Force after 20 years service. My husband and I came back to make our home here in 1959. Since then, our three children and their children also live here, so we have a broad stake in this, our adopted home. I have been involved in numerous volunteer activities over the years, and after writing for both newspapers in Anchorage, I chose at the end of 1963 to become a freelance writer. doctor, which profession I still follow. The work has taken me around the state often and has brought me in contact with many people. Much of what I present here has been discussed with several of these persons who concur with my thinking. You will be besieged by suggestions on where to invest the permanent fund, how to spend its income. Choosing among these suggestions will be a most demanding job, and I hope that you can maintain your thoughtful approach and not succumb to impulse or sudden pressure of a particularly vocal group. When the state received the then unprecedented $900 million in oil and gas case bonuses in 1969, the late Gene Guest convened a series of seminars to get public opinion on how to use the riches. He invited a group of Alaskans from all regions and representing a broad cross-section of interests in the state to meet with the faculty from the Brookings Institute. I was privileged to be an editor for the series and helped to record and summarize the final report of what the people wanted. It was noteworthy that with one exception, everyone who came, no matter how regional his prior feelings, soon put regionalism aside and truly addressed the subject of what was best for Alaska and its people as a whole. The specifics are on record, but the overall findings showed that it did not matter how much money the state had, a lot or a little, the desires would be the same, to maintain that peculiar Alaskan quality of life and to enhance it. Brainstorming sessions revealed that defining quality of life was a bit more complicated, each related to his or her particular experiences, attitudes, and lifestyle. Basically, however, accomplishing this goal would include these things: protection of environmental values, conserve non-renewable resources, develop renewable resources, particularly fisheries, provide educational opportunities which fit people's needs and desires, encourage cultural development, support the strong, independent character of Alaskans. It was suggested in the discussions that Alaska could skip certain historic phases in development, such as industrial, and could find innovative approaches to economic questions, although few specific programs were presented by the faculty. At the same time the Brookings findings were making their impact, a new phrase was heard throughout the land. Alaskans have the last chance to do it differently, to profit by mistakes made in the South Fork Gate. The phrase was used most often by those from the lower states as they addressed various publics on such matters as building the pipeline, that's capital letters. Soon it will be a decade since those first questions. How and where that money was spent is not the issue here, but attitudes of people, particularly leaders, and how they've approached the ideals are very much the issue. Alaskans, for all their vaunted strengths, are also very human. They too can be and often are greedy, short-sighted, impulsive, unwilling to consider all the options. They find it difficult to live up to their own statements of how to achieve a better society. But perhaps this time the leadership, you in fact, can help guide the people toward fulfilling life. You will certainly be asked to help make life a little easier for Alaskans, and that if done with wisdom is a valid consideration. I fervently hope that totally cutting out various taxes which support our necessary institutions and government functions will not be the way you ease their lives. The evidence is everywhere that when people do not pay their own way, when they are unaware of cost for services, when they have no grasp of what it took to make or build something, that they put little value on the somethings which come with no effort, and that they also lose in strength and character. On top of that, if costs of living are reduced too greatly in Alaska, it will open the floodgates for all the freeloaders who only want to get in on the freebies, but not to contribute to the growth and stability of the state. And finally, I would ask that you look to ways of enhancing what we have rather than getting more or of setting up the machinery which would lead to the more and more syndrome. So, with that philosophical background, here's my specific suggestion. Establish a percentage of the income from the permanent fund to be available on an annual basis to Alaskan communities for use in connection with cultural facilities.
Could you say that again, please?
Establish a percentage of the income from the permanent fund to be available on an annual basis to Alaskan communities for use in connection with cultural facilities. A formula would be developed for communities according to population and could be weighted in a manner to be more helpful those communities with less economic viability. The funds would be available on application and would not require matching in kind or money. A community would have to demonstrate fiscal responsibility in use of the funds and show that a cultural facility, as defined later here, actually exists or is actively being planned. There would be no strings on how the money was used for the facility. That is, the only approval of use would be to show that the money would be used for some aspect, such as design for a new facility or complex, contribution to actual construction of such, maintenance or programming for the facility, or addition of a wing, etc., acquisition of artworks or museum material, salary for a curator or director, assistance in retiring debt on an existing facility, furnishings for such, new or to upgrade, sponsorship of a program recognized as valid for the type of facility, for example, an instructor in management of such an institution, an artist in residence, special performance assistance to an outside group, etc. These could be specified or it could be shown what would not be allowed. The facility would have to be truly representative of public interest. To define a cultural facility, it is defined as a facility or complex which has its principal function serving the arts activities of the community through theater, concert hall, museum, and or gallery, with additional compatible uses such as conventions, community meetings, and library services as determined by each community. The money could be allocated through the offices of, for example, the State Council on the Arts and its member local arts councils, or an authority or commission set up especially for this matter, always keeping in mind that the local interests get true representation. The object would be not to add another layer of government, but to safeguard allocations so that communities would indeed have local authority and their projects be valid. The percentage of the permanent fund thus allocated could be invested in a separate account, thus earning and enlarging while applications were pending. Penalties could be established for misuse of funds. An annual application date would have to be determined for such applications and grants so that the amount available could be related to requests. There is extensive justification why this is an important consideration. A 1975 report found that 93% of the adult American population felt that cultural activities and facilities were important to their lives, and the growth of the arts has reflected this appreciation. A professor interested in the views on art of the average working person talked with 400 blue-collar workers, maids, clerks, mechanics, bus and truck drivers, cab drivers, secretaries, hotel desk clerks, waitresses, carpenters, and street laborers, as they went about their daily tasks. Their opinions were written up in the study, Opinions of Working People Concerning Art. Some critics hailed it as the first tell it like it is audience pulse feeler done in a long time. Generally, the professor said, workers interviewed believed that art is necessary to the enjoyment, fulfillment, and pleasure of living. A majority also think that tax money should be used to fund artists and art projects. And this is a quote from the report. We found that contrary to the general belief, they, man and woman on the street, like art, enjoy it, feel it worthwhile, know much more than we, the arts world, give them credit for. And of course, we discovered what we should have known all along, that most of them dabble in it themselves. Sunday painters or collectors of everything from antiques to Ming vases, coins, stamps, that they act in neighborhood groups, sing in choruses and quartets, or save their money for tickets for special performances of plays, operas, ballets, which appeal to them. As a bartender told one interviewer, art brings most of us closer to what we really are and what we feel. A similar survey done in the Anchorage Borough 3 years ago revealed the same points of view and willingness to help art projects. The preamble to the bylaws of an 11-community cultural facilities development committee, and I believe you are aware of it through some appropriation to the Southeast Regional Arts Council, or beginnings of it, and I can tell you the names of the communities involved in this are at present are Dillingham, Naknek, Anchorage, Haines, Skagway, Juneau, Sitka, Ketchikan, Wrangell, Hoonah, and Petersburg. And I'm on the executive board of that committee. Now then, where was I? The preamble of that committee reads, "We who are involved in the arts know the importance of cultural facilities to the life of the community. We also know how stifling the lack of such facilities can be to cultural growth. Our task will be to make the voters of the state aware of what cultural facilities can contribute to our communities. Cultural centers can become the focal point for a variety of community activities. They can answer the question of young people, what is there to do? Provide entertainment, cultural enrichment, recreation, instruction, and social opportunity for all the people in the community, as well as for those who visit our villages and cities. Along with Alaska's rapid economic development, there is a growing awareness of Alaska's renewable human resources. Civilizations are remembered for their lasting contribution to the arts, humanities, and mankind. By providing a cultural home for the arts, artists, and Alaska's ever-growing art audience, these centers proposed for Alaska will contribute to such an endowment." That's the end of the preamble. "If ever there were something which would contribute to and enhance the quality of life in Alaska, participation in creative endeavors is it. And having a facility where it can happen, a situation usually beyond the capabilities of any but the wealthiest of cities, would be the catalyst. We can do it differently in Alaska, and this is one exciting, beautiful way. And we do care how they do it outside, because that's where we learn both what to do and what not."
Thank you very much, Betsy. I appreciate the philosophical bend of your statement, since that's what we're really after today, not the technical aspect. Someone said in Fairbanks yesterday we can hire a mechanic to fix our car, but we don't ask the mechanic where we want to drive it, and I just appreciated your point of view. Are there any questions, Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Really appreciate that. Outstanding presentation. Betsy, while you were putting your presentation together, did you spend any time at all wrestling with the problem of the income producing limitations under which we're restrained?
Say it again, please.
In so far as a permanent fund, we're somewhat limited to income producing.
She mentioned dedication of the income, mm-hmm.
Yes.
For this purpose.
Not the main fund, but a specific percentage, which and I wouldn't think that it would be our responsibility to figure out the formula. When the management group is there, this could be done.
Thank you.
But it would go on in the community, you know, forever.
Thank you.
Representative Meekin.
Yeah, Ms. Woodman, one of the questions that keeps coming up, and I think it's a good one, is why would a certain proposal be more appropriate or better accomplished through the use of the permanent fund than through the general fund or some of the other funding mechanisms available to the state? And the reason I think that's a good question is because I'm assuming that people voted for the fund in order to circumvent the normal funding mechanism, which is through the general fund. And if we were to fund all of the needs that have been demonstrated, or even the good ideas that have been demonstrated to us in just a couple of days of hearings, I think we'd end up with something very similar to the general fund, because there are, of course, a great many needs in the state, and we try to address them through the normal budget process. So it's becoming clearer to me that, or at least I'm starting to think in terms of the permanent fund being used for activities that are more appropriate to it than to the general fund, and I'm wondering if you had any chance to think in those terms at all.
I suppose I go in terms of what our experience has been in trying to get such things to the general fund. The demands for very basic economics related things has been so intense that it is very difficult to address to this, and it's kind of too bad to always have this the leftover thing when I have a feeling that this, I've lived long enough and been experienced enough to realize that this kind of thing is more important than an awful lot of other things. We use the phrases, you know, you don't live by bread alone, and we say it very glibly, but the great deal of investigation into the internals of how people think and how they live these days, the young people's protests have been to discover that the things really don't answer their needs. They are not the thing. I had the opportunity to gather a great deal of information from people who had participated in Cry the Wild Ram over the years at Kodiak. And this was an amazing thing, what it meant to individuals to be part of this. It had nothing to do with who came, who saw, who benefited as an audience. It had to do with the person's relation to other people, a sense of creativity, a sense of belonging, a sense of history of their area, which they gained things that, and they were very emotional about this. They felt that it had given a direction to their lives. And, you know, not everybody has ski boots or can afford them, and not everybody wants to go down the mountain, and not everybody can play in an orchestra. But in a cultural facility, there's a place for anybody who wants to be there. And the responsibilities, of course, on the community is to generate how it's used. And in Naknek, museum and the saving of their artifacts seems to be their major need now. This might change over the years. In some of the larger urban areas, the dramatic presentations and the music presentations become more important. But I've taught school over the years. I've taught music and I've worked in theater and so on. And my experience has been over and over again that it has been the saving thing to many a person because he's found a place where he belongs and it's important to him. His community is alive.
I think you make a very compelling argument for the need for these types of things in our lives, but I guess what you're saying is that because of historically, you don't feel that it's been funded enough or quickly enough or something through the general fund, and since the permanent fund would allow us to, in essence, dedicate a certain percentage year after year, and people. Wanting appropriations for the arts wouldn't have to continually make presentations and try to get them from the state, that since it would be a dedicated fund, that would be a more secure way of funding it. And then that's the reason you look to the permanent fund then?
I think so, yes. Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
I'd like to comment on
okay, well, normally we'll go out of our usual format to do that as long as we don't get involved in the debate. Go ahead.
Her idea is quite a bit like mine on using the income of a permanent fund for recreation facilities, campgrounds, art galleries, convention centers, and things. I think we're going to have to keep our taxes up a ways to keep all of the freeloaders coming in, and to rather than take the income from the permanent fund and put it into the general fund to maybe reduce our taxes too low, designate some of this money for some of the more social aspects of our living, and mm-hmm. rather than just have it all go into the general mm-hmm. fund.
I guess your only disagreement is on opera, right?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I think we have time for the last listed witness, Harold Pomeroy. And then at that point, I think we'll break for lunch, and it's a free-for-all. The way we did it in Fairbanks is anyone who wanted to testify next just came up here, and the first one to get here got it. Everyone was very gentlemanly about it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was plagued in attempting to prepare testimony because it seemed to me that I didn't have anything to say that you didn't already know. And
well, that's not true.
Specialist or professional in particular fields of finance, I was uncertain as to how to proceed in the use of this director. I decided to take a look at your preliminary report by this House Special Committee, thinking that represented a lot of your thinking, a lot of your studying, and if I commented on that, that it might aid you a little bit in your further deliberations. I also thought that I could be most useful, if useful at all, by proceeding from my own experiences in the field in Alaska and making reference to them. I have prepared my testimony, and you have copies of it. I think it well to read through it so there's a lot of questions. The work of your committee merits high marks. It is clear that you are laying out as many pertinent facts and as much useful information as feasible. The preliminary report by your committee on the Alaska Permanent Fund is evidence of its quality in your efforts. The report is a good start. The issues and considerations bearing on the permanent fund are so complex and extraordinary, however, that enough data from which to draw well-considered conclusions will tend to make any report of general distribution overly long. This is a handicap, and I interject there that we are possessed of a great many illusions, a great many hopes and aspirations that are just that. For example, recently, the Urban Observatory conducted an attitudinal study on the lower end of the Kenai Peninsula and contacted more than half the families there. And in asking about what the people would like to see develop, what they'd like to see evolve, 92% of them said that emphasis should be on agriculture. Well, agriculture started on the Kenai Peninsula in 1949, and it is negligible now. And however a person might feel emotionally about agriculture as versus industrialization, for example, there is a large part of illusion there, as there is in some of our other hopes and aspirations. Such qualifications as I may have to appear before you on the public permanent fund come mostly from actual experiences. My first contact with Alaska was in 1948 when I flew here from Vienna, Austria to take a look. In addition to personal interest, it was also the purpose to do off-the-record reconnaissance for groups representing war-weary Europeans looking for a fresh start by resettlement. General Kepler provided me with a C-46 to fly around the Kenai Peninsula, Matanuska Valley, and Susitna area for an entire day. When I returned and talked with John Gorsuch, then president of the Chamber of Commerce, and queried others, it seemed to me the potentials for economically sound large-scale settlement, and particularly with reference to agricultural industry, would be too meager to be feasible.